So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
The second the Ole chants ended, it was replaced by Drake, 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 or Elgin, Elgin. Where's my fucking chant? Here's the thing. A lot of people still chant fight, steam, fight, kill, steam, kill, all this shit. But the fact that there's even three or four people in that crowd that are booing me pisses me off. This is what happened to these guys. You, I'll get to you later. But you see, I'm Kevin Steen and I made this goddamn place. Yeah. So who the fuck do you think you are when you buy your ticket to come sit and boo me? Fuck you. The Night's Miracle left. Nobody cared that I was in the fucking ring. All they cared about was streamers. Ole, ole, he's leaving. He's a big fucking hero. Then he cuts a little fucking promo. Oh my God, suddenly he has some English words he can spew out of his ugly fucking face. But he's leaving and everybody's sucking his dick.
That's Adam's thing.
It is Adam's thing. You. I hate you. So much. You are such a piece of shit.
Hey, what's chill?
But I'm a piece of shit.
That's true.
I can appreciate pieces of shit. And they always say, if you can't beat them, join them.
Yes.
Well, I tried to beat you, and I couldn't. So now, I got your goddamn back.
Ooh.
I'm not going to suck your dick, but I will make everybody who tries to stand in your way suck your dick. Everyone. Tell me who. Candace, Elgin, Joey Ryan.
Yeah.
Not these two.
I don't do that.
They're good Christian boys. They don't do that shit.
Right on.
The bottom line is this. A couple months ago, I came here with 100 t-shirts in my bag. I sold 60. That's pretty good, right?
That's great.
Yes.
But there's 500 people in this fucking place, so why didn't I sell 100?
Yeah.
PWG fans, take me for granted.
You got a valid point, Kev.
They took you two for granted
for years
now. All of a sudden, you notice a couple months ago, fuck the Young Bucks.
Right.
Oh, wait, but the other half says, let's go Young Bucks.
Right.
You know what? It's too late for that, you pieces of shit. I'm sorry for all the swearing. I know you guys don't like it.
I'm censoring it.
I like it.
It's too late for that, you pieces of ass.
There you go.
You think you're so effing cool all of a sudden? Let's go Young Bucks. It's too late. It's too late for PWG. You see this?
Mm-hmm.
We are the champions. Where's my belt? I don't need a goddamn belt. I made this place. I'm the champion of the universe.
Mr. PWG.
They are the PWG Tag Team Champions.
Yes.
He is the PWG World Champion. And we are the Mount Rushmore of professional wrestling.
Matt Rushmore.
Matt Rushmore.
Matt Rushmore, guys.
That's not what we're putting on the shirt. Mount Rushmore.
Mount Rushmore. I like
Matt Rushmore. And this is just the beginning. Suck our dicks.
I ain't your friend and you're not mine. This difference helps me cross the line. Every time I'm confronted,
it's Review Away, and I am John Pollock along with Wei Ting.
It is I.
Did you miss me?
Not really.
No.
I spoke to you yesterday.
But this is a different setting.
Oh, is it?
Very different. Different room, different show, different topic.
Well,
same. Yes, subject.
And the answer
matter.
Is yes. I really missed you.
How are you? You sound
room.
Exhausted, Wei.
Ah, no, I'm not. Not really. I'm okay. How are you?
I have an update.
Oh, you're on your earwax?
It's gotten worse.
Oh, that's not good.
I could barely sleep last night. It was so uncomfortable.
They can't rush this appointment, eh?
I don't think so.
Oh, boy. Well,
Tuesday cannot come soon enough.
Yeah. Good luck.
Oh, Jesus.
Lasting that long.
Do you want a coffee? Do you want some cocaine? Like what do you need?
What's wrong? What am I supposed to say to that?
You just
I feel bad for you. I can't. It's not like I can flush out that earwax for you.
Don't worry about my ear. My ear's fine.
Oh, okay.
Notice how it's this one that is facing you. So yeah. I can hear half of you fine.
Maybe I'm trying to think what other remedies. I don't know. Maybe
I'm taking drops right now, but that to me made it worse.
Maybe what helps typically with that type of thing outside of a professional?
Well, it sounds like a lot of this you can do yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm kind of tempted to try.
You can buy one of those pumps yourself.
Exactly. So I don't know. I kind of want to rely on a professional to do it properly.
Can you wait that long till Tuesday?
We're going to find out. It's going to be a long weekend for me.
Yeah, I know.
This is my life.
Well, maybe you should just try not listening to anything. Like maybe if you couldn't hear out of your other ear either, then it wouldn't be so bad.
Then I'd be deaf.
Yeah, it'd be a vow of deafness instead of like people going vows of silence.
Yeah. Well, if I go deaf, that would be a wonderful attribute to have for what I do for a living.
Interesting. I'm sure that exists. I'm sure there are deaf people involved in radio.
I'm sure there are.
And they'll take visual cues, you know? Sign language, though.
Wait, would you have to learn sign language, though?
I could
lip read.
Yeah, you could lip read.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it could be done, but
like Joey Lucas from The West Wing.
I don't want to say. Skype interviews, though, forget those.
Done?
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Skype is...
Oh, unless
annoying.
You had videos chat, then you'd be okay.
That's true.
So then, you know what? Hearing's overrated.
I know this is a repeat topic, but I'm going to ask it because I don't know the answer. But what is the sense you would give up first? I know we've had this conversation.
Smell.
Smell you would
no
give
doubt.
Up first.
I don't know why I want smell anyway. It's a hindrance.
It's a lot of bad stuff you smell.
Yeah.
I would imagine if you honestly paid attention to it, you smell more bad things than good.
My sense of smell is actually already pretty bad, so that would definitely be the first to give up.
I wonder how you know when your sense of smell is deteriorating or disappearing.
Yeah, you're right. I don't know.
It'd be hard to detect. I mean,
true.
Sight, hearing,
yeah.
I mean, that's pretty obvious.
Yeah.
But smell, how would you know?
Yeah. Are there smelling aids like there are hearing aids?
A friend of mine was born without the sense of smell. And I think it took him a long time to figure that out. I mean, if you were born without it, you don't know any different.
Well, obviously it could be very dangerous. Let's say you smell smoke.
Oh, of course.
That's bad. But come on, you could die from carbon monoxide anyway. We're all susceptible to that. It's odorless.
Very true. It's a scary world out there.
You could die from a lot of things. Smell would be my answer, John. What about yours? Touch.
Yeah, I'd be willing to negotiate with that sense.
Just rather be numb, your whole paralyzed essentially.
None of these options are a positive. None of them are something you would covet.
You'd retain smell over touch?
No, I'd probably do smell, but I'm trying to be a little different from you. But I'm saying that of them, if you take out smell, touch would probably be next.
Yeah.
Sight and hearing, I couldn't imagine being without.
And then what is it? What's the other one?
Touch, feel, hear.
The other one? I think we only got four.
The five senses.
Yeah, what the fuck is the fifth one?
Dude, my head.
That's the one we should get rid of. Nobody thinks about it.
Five senses.
Seeing dead people?
Sense, taste, sight, touch, smell, and hearing. Touch.
Sorry, we said touch.
Taste.
Taste.
Yeah,
oh, taste. Right. Taste. Yeah.
I wouldn't want to get rid of taste.
Yeah. No, I'd keep taste.
Yeah.
But you'd keep...
Touch
taste?
Is different.
You keep taste over touch?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I would.
Now, could you feel your food if you could still taste it?
Maybe not. That'd be weird. I don't know how touch would really... Like, what would you feel like?
Who determined these five senses?
M. Night Shyamalan.
Yeah, I think, no, he determined the sixth one.
Oh, right. That means it was always there to begin with. He just didn't realize it until the end of the movie.
Well, I've definitely missed this grade A banter.
You know what Kevin Owens' favorite sense is?
Here it comes.
Fight.
Okay.
He's got it twice in everything.
I thought it was kill.
That was Kevin Steen.
Yeah, one
different guy. Yeah. Today we are chatting about the new Kevin Owens documentary, Fight, Owens Fight.
Mm-hmm.
And both of us have watched this. And later on in the show, we're going to be joined by Pat LaPrade, somebody that is probably the most qualified to speak about this man outside of Kevin's immediate family and himself.
And Sami Zayn, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Pat is going to join us to share his thoughts on the documentary, which he makes a number of cameos in.
He does.
Yes. That I didn't even notice that he pointed out to me.
Okay.
Do you know did you watch the extras?
I watched all the extras.
Okay. Great. You know the scene where they're in the bar and his dad starts chopping? Yeah. A young Pat LaPrade is like cheering behind them.
Amazing.
In the whole thing. And then he's showing in the crowd. As well in the WWE.
Cool.
So there was Pat LaPrade all over this, but not interviewed. So we have someone
fight LaPrade fight this
fight LaPrade. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have nothing witty to top that with. So Pat will join us a little later on. I'm glad you watched both. In watching both.
Yeah.
It felt like a 2-hour documentary that they just separated.
Completely. I probably wouldn't have watched the extras if you didn't mention how good they were.
I wouldn't have either if Pat hadn't have told me to watch them.
Right.
So I don't know why this, whatever. They had their reasoning.
The extras are so loaded on this DVD that you really get the sense that this was a 2-hour documentary that they formatted either for the network or whatever 1-hour format they choose to continue with in the future. But it's essentially just, like, they're not just cutscenes. They are like really well produced little vignettes that tell you his full story.
Yeah. It just felt like they had this 2-hour documentary that they just cut in half.
Yeah.
And I think both are essential. I view this as a 2-hour documentary instead of a 1-hour documentary with extras.
Yeah. I suppose like the little maybe extra features kind of work off better as their own little vignettes rather than as part of a bigger narrative in some ways. But some of them definitely do fit.
Did you get up to Unfiltered?
Yeah, I sat through all that.
We learned the correct pronunciation of Rene Paquette.
It's Paquette.
I think that's how she said it.
Paquette.
Paquette. Huh. Because Rene compliments Owens on properly enunciating her name.
Okay.
And we even got a score reference in this interview.
The score and a screenshot.
That's right. Yes. No Arda. But it was Renee nonetheless.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we also on this show are going to have some old interviews with Kevin Steen and Kevin Owens.
How old?
I looked these up. Some of these I didn't even remember. I just searched my name
that
and
you've
Kevin
done
Steen.
Them.
I did them. Yes. Yeah. Two of these interviews I remembered. One of them completely forgot about.
Where are they from?
Okay. The first one is from May of... the first one is from WrestleMania weekend 2012 for the Showdown in the Sun event in Miami, Florida.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was the night of a last man standing match between him and El Generico. Then the other one was a few months later, right after Steen won the ROH title outside of the Ted Reeve Arena,
mm-hmm.
where he's got his arm around me with the title.
Oh, yeah.
As all these people are in the background. It was quite the chaotic scene. And
I shot all these. Why am I asking you these? I forget.
Dude,
I did them and
barely remember these. And then there was the one at Access from Mania Weekend 2015, where he's the NXT champion
mm-hmm.
and was injured that weekend, which is where they had that San Jose card that Owens was not able to wrestle on.
I think very nearly we could have had an interview, perhaps even from 2005. Because that was the first time I had seen Kevin Steen live in person.
Is that UWA?
Yes, it was. It was the UWA, and it was when we were filming a documentary on Christopher Bishop, who is a local indie wrestler. One of the first things I think you and I ever worked on for school.
Yeah.
Which is
award-winning documentary, is not a lie.
It's still up there somewhere. And anyway, please, it's no indication of our current level of work, but... a young Mr. Wrestling Kevin Steen, a part of that evening's festivities as well.
You know what I would love one day is to sit down and try and put together like a little retrospective look at UWA. Because all their stuff was shot and it used to air on Byte TV. And if you looked at the names that came through UWA, it's astounding. It's incredible.
Sure.
Kevin Steen being just one of them. But mm-hmm. it was quite the cavalcade of future stars that came through that promotion.
Yeah.
What was I going to say? I was going to say something here, and I totally blanked on it. So I guess to start this off
Spoilers. Spoilers, no, everybody.
Yeah.
This man wins the WWE Championship.
Oh, you guys ruined everything. So one of the things that I thought stood out to me the most in watching this documentary that I think is going to be a trend for future documentaries of this generation and beyond is how much stuff is caught on tape.
Oh, yeah.
Like, Steen had his training sessions with Jacques Rougeau filmed in this, early matches for IWS, EWR, and of course the Ring of Honor footage that is present all over this, mm-hmm. which I don't even know what this documentary would look like if they didn't strike that deal with ROH. That would be, like, contrast that to Steen's time in PWG, which I'm sure he would credit as just as important as ROH, and it's barely mentioned in this as compared to ROH, which is all mm-hmm. over this.
But they did have some PWG footage, just not much in comparison.
See, I don't even remember any PWG footage.
Yeah, there was. There was at least a shot or two, but certainly not on the level of the ROH footage that was integrated in this. And I would say, like, more so than CM Punk's documentary, more so than any of the documentaries that they've done, this featured the most Ring of Honor footage of any WWE production.
This was huge. And if you were going to be doing a documentary, it did need it, especially if you're telling the Sami Zayn story.
It bodes really well for, you know, future documentaries that may come out on guys like a Samoa Joe, perhaps. And I thought it was completely unnecessary for a Kevin Owens DVD to feature all that, and I'm really glad it did. But that's not to say they only focused on that stuff, because I would say, to me, it felt like the majority of the drama and the interest in this documentary took place within the last 3 years once he got into the WWE.
And that was the lion's share of the documentary. Yeah. It was WWE 75% of this, which mm-hmm. I was still happy with the 25%. Mm-hmm. It was a refreshing era to hear in a WWE documentary because these documentaries are great, but I don't need one more documentary on the Monday Night War era. And this is a totally different era and generation that these are fresh stories. Mm-hmm. These are fresh faces, new voices. You had Jimmy Jacobs interviewed on this.
Well, that's the other thing, is that everybody involved in Kevin Steen's Ring of Honor run is now employed by the WWE.
Yeah, you have Jacobs, Carino, Zayn, obviously, Tyler Black, Seth Rollins, who comes across as, you know, a really good friend of Steen, but also his most vocal critic and providing constructive criticism to him and always telling him that his look was going to stop him from advancing. And that was not an unpopular opinion 5 years ago. That was always the tag on Steen, is that this is a world-class performer whose body is going to hold him back.
I don't think Tyler Black, Seth Rollins was saying anything that none of us would have said. Wouldn't have also said if we were really good friends with this guy and wanted to see him succeed as well.
Are we wrong if we had that thought in 2012? Because today it looks laughable that you would argue if this guy deserved a spot in the company, and his body isn't all that different.
Obviously, if you and I were fans, or if Tyler Black was a fan of Kevin Steen in Ring of Honor, we don't give a shit what he looks like. But I think it's our perception of what Vince McMahon thinks that is what's come into question. And I guess Vince has changed his mind in recent years.
So I talk about this later in the interview with Pat, but what do you feel was the biggest reason for that change? Because I'm with you. I think 2011, Steen isn't getting a peak. And today, there's no question. That guy is mm-hmm. one of the most important performers on that roster.
A big part of it, obviously, is Triple H, who Kevin Steen gives almost full credit to in this documentary for his success in the WWE. I think the creation of NXT, obviously, and I would largely attribute it to Hunter wanting to kind of mine the indies in order to fill out his new promotion, NXT. And I guess Vince McMahon also seeing the benefits of, you know, having these guys appear on his sub-brand and then translating them into his main roster.
I think it was key for those people, obviously, to get on board with this. But to me, I think 10 years from now, especially if he never wrestles another match, that to me is going to be the biggest legacy of CM Punk. is that I feel he was the one that opened their eyes to being less narrow-minded when it comes to talent they're looking for, especially talent that can talk, which I feel there was a perception that this talent on the independents are just these high spot guys that can't talk and aren't complete performers that we look for. And mm-hmm. Punk changed that perception for them, and Brian Danielson as well.
Certainly. I look forward to the History of Ring of Honor DVD that I feel WWE will put out one day.
One day? You mean that ROH would go out of business, or just that they would do?
I hope they never go out of business, but I if anybody is to put together I want WWE's level of production is what I think I mean to say. You know, when it comes to these retrospective lookbacks at the histories of companies, I'd love to see like the story of Ring of Honor. You know what I mean?
It'd be a fantastic documentary because they'd have no problem having Gabe. Adam Pearce is there. So there are two of your key bookers along the years. Like a full ROH story would be outstanding. And you'd have access to everybody. That's why these documentaries, I have such a high expectation level for. One, though, you have to navigate the WWE narrative at times. But they have access to anyone they want. Mm-hmm. So I think the expectation level should be high because of the resources they have.
They certainly have to kind of fit some type of WWE narrative. I don't disagree at all. But I also feel like these DVD production groups operate with a bit of autonomy in the stories that they're able to tell. And I have to imagine they didn't come to this – like Vince McMahon didn't tell them, you're doing a Kevin Owens DVD, make sure you get that Ring of Honor stuff in there. I'm sure it was just like something that they kind of thought was relevant to the story, and it's something that they seem to go out of their way to try to pick the things that tell the story the best, you know, whether or not it might please the company.
Yeah, I feel, you know, just guessing here that it's a lot of kind of unspoken pressure. I am sure nobody spoke to Neville, but when he's going over saying Steen and Generico was the hottest feud outside of the WWE, it's just, I'm sure no one told him that. Yeah. And it was just, I mean, tell me the hot feud that was happening in December 2010 in the WWE after the Nexus had been blown out. But anyway.
Do you find it interesting that they decided to make a DVD on Kevin Owens at all and not on, say, see, like, the people that they've done DVDs on are people like CM Punk, Paul Heyman, Kevin Owens. People very much that are interesting to the internet, quote-unquote, internet wrestling fan base. You know what I mean?
I think that's who these DVDs are aimed at.
Yeah, completely. They haven't done a DVD on Sheamus, or at least a documentary. They haven't done one on The Miz. They haven't done one on, quote-unquote, their kind of, like, homegrown talent, you know what I mean? And it's guys like a Kevin Owens or a Daniel Bryan or a CM Punk or a Paul Heyman who get this treatment.
It's a very targeted audience that are like, let me ask you this question. If I told you right now to go out and buy the Kevin Owens DVD, where would you go? I wouldn't even know
Amazon.
Where to, you have to go to a physical place to buy the DVD.
Best Buy maybe?
Maybe. I don't know if it's there. I have no idea. I don't even know what I would do right now if I needed to go buy a DVD of anything, regardless of wrestling or not, but something very niche like wrestling.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even know where to find this.
So what are you saying?
It tells me that it's an audience that has to be seeking this out. I don't think you're getting a non-fan that sees this in the aisleway and is just picking this up because this guy looks interesting and you kind of know what wrestling is about and you're getting a casual audience. I think this is all Kevin Owens fans that are buying this, and you got to cater to them.
An older audience.
Yes.
Than, say, maybe who they're targeting their toys to.
Yes.
Although they do target their toys to older audiences too.
Yeah, that they do. But I think for these kind of DVD releases, which is a medium that is drastically drying out for this company, I think that within 2 years, they won't even be producing DVDs. I think these will go straight to the network, which they eventually do end up on. So is there anyone – first of all, let me ask you about the people that you enjoyed hearing from in this beyond just your – Owens Zane types. Like, who were some voices maybe that you thought really stood out?
I mean, outside of Owens, who I think, is a perfect documentary subject because he's so good on camera and so honest
about his story. I thought he was fantastic. Generico played, rounded out kind of like, he's his best friend, you know, and he kind of told it from a best friend's perspective. He did a very good job. Trying to think who else really stood out to me from.
I liked hearing from his dad.
Yeah.
Terry.
Yeah. His dad was all right. You know, it really was a documentary that was largely just revolving around Kevin Owens and not so much anybody else. You had little segments from Triple H, from William Regal, and, Triple H, Kevin Owens really puts him over, and he has always put him over as the guy who kind of gave him his chance. I don't know. I'm sure there's really something to it, but there's just something that rubs me the wrong way a little bit to hear like Triple H remind us too, like that, hey, by the way, guys, I kind of did this. And he doesn't blatantly do it, but it's something like him retelling the story of like, oh, I just had a talk with Kevin Owens earlier. And then, Kevin was telling me, hey, that time, Regal came to PWG and noticed me. I think that's how I got signed. Well, and then Triple H goes, Kevin, who do you think sent William Regal down there? You know, whatever. It's cool. But like,
he's the kind of guy that you can at least acknowledge, like you did a great thing for this person, but yeah. It's much like,
but he's going out of his way to let you know.
Exactly.
That.
It's like me making a charitable donation anonymously and then telling you, hey, wait, this is what I just did.
And it's not just things like this. It's like, you know, coming out during the takeovers to receive the applause at the start of the show, taking the photos with every one of these guys who ends up winning an NXT championship, posting it up on the internet. You know what I mean? To show that the internet wrestling crowd, I helped do this. You know?
Well, and a lot of that I'm sure is very, very strategic in putting him in that front and center post Vince McMahon leadership role and attaching his name and face to this next generation and these successes and attaching him to the hip of all of this. So it's not just this large entity that is producing this. This is the vision of the God.
Yeah.
And I mean, you want to watch his DVD. I mean, that was something nuts by the end of it, where it's like, God, there's people.
That was almost
crazy.
Especially the last 5 minutes of that Triple H documentary, where I feel like I
was nauseous.
I would have to imagine Hunter himself probably thought it was too much, you know? So anyway, you can listen to that review if you wanted to hear us talk about that.
I really did like him going over the issues he had with Jacques Rougeau, which, you know, for those that have not seen it, I mean, that's where he first went to this barn to get trained at 16. The barn collapsed and he had to find a new place and went to Jacques Rougeau's training school. And at that time, Jacques Rougeau was doing these shows at the football stadium, and they were very big shows. Like, he was drawing thousands for these shows, and I'd always be reading about the attendance, and they were incredible. And we kind of get to look at the structure of these shows, that Jacques was very controlling of the wrestlers he trained. He wanted them exclusively, even though he'd only be running every couple of months, and using months of buildup to structure a match together. And it was just very unorthodox in how you train wrestlers. And Steen was very, very loyal to Jacques, but then he wanted to venture out and he wanted to be working for promotions like IWS, which was a much more different new age promotion, kind of in that post ECW light. And that eventually led to this ultimatum where Rougeau was promising Steen that if he stayed with him, he was going to get a dark match, promising that the WWE's coming to town with Raw, but Steen was never given a date. He was just given this promise that eventually it would come, and he eventually makes this decision, which features a promo.
By the way, Rougeau wanted to sign with him, and then
he wanted a 10-year deal with Steen and would get a percentage of all his earnings, which is a trap some wrestlers, especially multiple generations ago, would fall into, where you'd have to pay your trainer in perpetuity for getting you booked. So Steen eventually turned it down and went his own way. And Rougeau did get a spot later with two of his guys in May of 2004. They did get a dark match. It was not Steen being involved here, but that was the break, and the two haven't talked since.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have liked to have heard from Jacques in this. He doesn't really have that relationship with the WWE. But for a number of these stories, I kind of wanted to hear from the other side too. I thought that would have just made for a more interesting story.
Completely. I think his voice was probably the one that I feel was most missing from this documentary because he was focused on so much. Perhaps the other being Jim Cornette, but he was kind of a less smaller portion of his Owens's story, I think. But Rougeau, I think, would have been great to hear from. And I don't know. I wonder. I imagine like how thorough the research is done for these documentaries that maybe the producers did go try to get in contact with him, but maybe for one reason or another that didn't pan out.
We also have, you know, just from the Quebec scene, I mean, what was the wrestling scene at that time, which we chat about a lot with Pat coming up, but that was, to me, it was just the fact that footage existed, it got some focus in the documentary.
I was amazed at the amount of this dude's life that was documented on video. And, you mentioned the training footage at the Rougeaus, but this footage of him, wrestling was really cool too. What's amazing is like, this dude was like, we know him as this kind of big chubby guy, but he was kind of a skinnier man in his youth. Not unlike his own child. Like in a lot of scenes, there's like a very striking similarity between, how he looks here and what his kid will probably look like in 2 to 3 years.
Yeah. And we kind of see that progression as well with his personality, which I mentioned the IWS promo, which they had saved here where he's explaining the ultimatum that Jacques Rougeau gave him that he would have to leave IWS. And the promo culminates in him saying that he's not going to take that deal. He wants to get to the WWE on his own terms.
Yeah.
And it's really impressive to hear this guy. This was around 2003, 2004. So he's about 19, 20 years old. English is his second language. Mm-hmm. And he's cutting good promos 13, 14 years ago.
It's amazing that he can speak this language and talk better in this language than many of the people that were speaking it for a lot longer than him. He has a great story in this documentary about learning English from watching Jim Ross and watching, I guess Jerry Lawler call pro WWE matches. So you learn from the get-go that this man really wants to work in the WWE.
And I think that if you take away those promos, I don't know if he is hired, even at that time period by WWE, because there was an extra in here of his tryout promo at NXT where it's a true story that Zayn had brought his contract and signed it with Steen, who was not getting hired, and using that as the motivation for his promo to get into the WWE when his best friend – it was almost like he took it as like this arrogant thing, signing this contract right in front of your friend as he's moving on and Steen staying in the same neutral position of his career. Mm-hmm. I feel it's his promos that.
Oh, yeah. It's his best skill.
100%. Like you take away the promos and that's, you know, he's a great wrestler, but it's the promos that set him apart. I don't think anyone will debate that. And it's just interesting to see that, like, he was cutting good promos at a very early age.
The promos were really good. And I think like so much of that stems from just this like cockiness and confidence he has about himself that comes across in the interviews themselves. You know, he just seems like a guy who is very sure of how good he is. You know what I mean? And, humble is not, okay. You know, I think he is humble in many ways, but I don't think he really lets it on. You know what I mean? Like he comes across like a guy who is very passionate and, you know,
very confident.
Very confident in his abilities.
Which I think is a trait that, yes, it can rub people the wrong way, but I feel for the top guys, it's kind of a necessary trait to have because you will get walked over if you're too humble. Yeah. And that was Zane's first impression, was watching tapes of him with Neil Felsenstein, who is wrestler Beef Wellington here. And Zane's asking about Steen, and he's like, yeah, he's really good, but he knows it too. Like that was Zane's first description of Steen that was given to him at the time. So I guess as well, their big breakthrough match that they talk about here was the four-way they had with Combat Zone Wrestling in 2004 with Steen, Generico, Sexy Eddie, and Excess, who went down and had this four-way match that tore the house down. And this was after this tournament of death where Sexy Eddie had severed like a tendon in his forearm and was gushing blood. And it kind of led everyone to kind of take notice of the Montreal scene at the time and open the doors for these other guys to come down a few months later. And they just tore down the house. And both Steen and Generico in this say that that four-way, that was the gateway. That opened up PWG. That got them booked all over the place after that. And it was kind of like Will Ospreay and Ricochet, where it was like Steen and Generico, that was the hot match to book, and right, they could take that match to all these different promotions.
Or CM Punk versus Chris Hero from IWA?
From IWA.
Yeah. That was kind of like the match that kind of got him noticed when he was coming up. It's really cool that they are willing to devote that time and attention to something that, you know, otherwise in previous years would probably be considered really small and not worth mentioning for a WWE documentary.
Maybe we'll get the CZW documentary down the road too. I guess, yeah. Damien's kind of done it.
Yeah, he has.
A little
actually.
Bit.
Yeah, he has.
A glimpse.
Yeah.
There's also the meeting that Steen had with Steve Austin in an airport,
right,
in 2005, where he asked his advice, which is
no footage of that, which
no,
I was almost disappointed.
I was amazed they didn't have a photo. I'm stunned we would have got one of those Sasha Banks photos.
Actually,
in the airport.
There was a photo. I don't know if
of
it
the
was,
two of them.
Yeah, from that Man, from that time, but I don't know if it was from that particular meeting or not. But like the way this documentary was like shaping up, I was surprised somebody wasn't hiding out with like a hidden camera.
Well, it was
like,
an airport. Maybe
everything.
There was a security issue.
Yeah, I guess so. But this man had filmed everything, I guess.
But it was great advice of all people for Kevin Steen. The advice of just keep running your mouth was important advice for Kevin Steen to take and really digest, which he obviously did. And it kind of came full circle when Steen, once he had signed with WWE, went on Steve Austin's podcast. And, you know, Steen and Generico have kept up their story like pretty tight. And the idea that El Generico has gone off to Mexico, and Steen is explaining what happened to El Generico, stating, oh, well, he had to retire from wrestling at the age of 32, and Austin is not aware of the story. So he's, God damn, 32 is not an old age. What was wrong?
Oh,
back
no.
injury? And Steen's just kind of biting his tongue and like,
oh,
he
no.
doesn't want to give up the story, but he's watching Austin just being totally sucked into the story of Zane and Generico living in alternate dimensions. It's a great story.
Oh.
But anyway.
That's on Austin, man. How do you know?
Well,
how do you fall for that?
I guess then we can go to the ROH time period here, and these guys come in, and Jimmy Jacobs is explaining that on most nights it was Brian Danielson was the most over guy, and then second it was Generico and Steen as a team. But they also rubbed the locker room the wrong way. Like, guys were very critical of them and their style. They were obviously very young, and you have these two Canadians coming in that maybe some weren't as familiar with. It's a very competitive locker room, especially at that time period in ROH, when you look at the names and some of the egos at that time, even in ROH. Like, you had a very ambitious locker room that's all trying to top each other. And Steen and Generico were doing it in somewhat of a unconventional way, I guess.
Right, right. I didn't watch a whole lot of his run in Ring of Honor, but I did, obviously always heard about some of the great matches they were having after they started to split and started to feud with one another. And they kind of positioned that whole feud as sort of a showcase of the creativity of both men, how they both had mapped out this whole feud with each other a year out.
Yeah, which they did the split at Final Battle 2009. They lost to the Young Bucks, and they show the scene in the documentary of Steen embracing Generico. He's crying, and then low blows him, and the audience goes nuts. And that was the impetus for the next year of programming, where Carino got involved, Colt Cabana got involved, and it built up to the next year's Final Battle, where Jim Cornette was now booking, and he added the stipulation that it would be Mask versus Career in their fight without honor. And Steen ends up losing, and it ended up being a pretty low point of Steen's career afterwards.
So what you're saying, Cornette booked this with the intention of Not bring steam back? Why would it be a
well, the idea local? At the time, as Cornette's kind of talked about, was not that steam would be gone forever, but that he'd disappear for a while, mm-hmm. lose some weight, and come back as a new pushed character.
What can you tell me? Because I'm still kind of in the dark about the Jim Cornette, Kevin Steen relationship, as far as you know.
I think, listen, and there's two sides to the story, and from, like, at the end of it, I don't believe in the idea that Cornette looked at both guys as just nothing. I mean, the fact is, he was looking at it from the idea that no one can miss you if you don't disappear first and do a big comeback with Steen months later. The mm-hmm. problem with that was that Steen leaving, he was making a lot less money in this point. Oh. And, you know, he wanted to be working and ended up coming back and got pushed as the anti-authority babyface. They put the title on him. But the two sides definitely clashed. And Cornette said him and Generico were very hard to work with. Steen and Generico had their own view of things. And Cornette at the time, I mean, he wanted to unmask Generico, who on the independent scene at that time, I mean, that was a big gimmick. It was a successful one. And what do I have to gain by unmasking in ROH?
Yet he just did it anyway.
Well, he did it when he signed with WWE, which is, you know, it's a big difference being.
I know.
You know, but true. From but Cornette's idea, he's looking at it from that the same viewpoint WWE probably was.
Yeah.
But they weren't seeing this as what dividends does this provide us by me unmasking now? And it's like WWE and ROH, it's a significant difference. I don't think Cornette saw it like
you
that.
You think in hindsight he feels like he should have done some type of unmasking thing just to make the money off of that rather than just go to WWE without doing anything?
I guess if he had known that he would be in WWE, maybe. Maybe he would have. But I also feel like there was no way he was going to be El Generico in NXT.
Interesting. Okay, no, sorry, because like they don't really brush too much on that, you know.
I think it was a big misstep not having Jim Cornette interviewed on this. I mean, it's not like the guy did a sit down with them WrestleMania weekend and they interviewed him about a bunch of stuff, and I think there was plenty of time that you could have got some insight from Cornette. Where I'm not saying one side's right over the other. I think both sides have their arguments, but mm-hmm. I think. I always prefer to hear both and then let the audience decide.
In business, especially a creative business, you always have disagreement.
I just don't feel Cornette is or was as anti-Kevin Steen and El Generico as some people believe he was. Mm. I think he did see especially Steen as a star, but he needed to lose some weight. And, you know, when Owens had to go to NXT, that's what he did. And that he didn't. You know, he had his own critique of Steen and Generico, and some agreed, some disagreed. But I think this would have been better if Cornette was involved in this.
Yeah.
So they dedicate a lot of time, a decent amount of time to that feud. And it really presents Steen as being at a low point here, where he even talks about doing an interview with Alan Cunahan, Alan Forel.
Oh, okay.
On a podcast where he was stating after that final battle event, he was considering leaving for a brief period of time before, and he was taken off TV for a while in 2011 and started working with PWG, and that kind of reinvigorated him. And then he started making appearances around June of 2011, and it built up to his return match at the end of the year. So, I mean, he was the most pushed guy come 2012 in ROH. So, I mean, they were going hard with him, and he was the most over character in ROH. I don't think there was any debate after that comeback in 2011. So, I mean, under that Jim Cornette booking era, I mean, Steen was the biggest babyface by 2012. And I guess now is a good time to hear our first interview from Kevin Steen, which is March of 2012. It's WrestleMania 28 weekend in Miami, and it was just hours before his last man standing match with Generico. This is March of 2012.
Pro wrestling's worst nightmare, Kevin Steen, and we're here in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, Kevin, which has really become the biggest weekend of the year for pro wrestling fans. Ring of Honor has been entrenched with these weekends for years, so it's got to be kind of a big shows for you guys for 2012.
Yeah, I think it's even bigger for me because I was held off last year's WrestleMania weekend shows for various reasons. So, getting to come back and, weekends like this, we have two shows Friday, Saturday, and it's always packed. So it's a good place for guys looking to make an impact to do it. So everybody's always really psyched for these shows, for sure.
Have you found that, you know, being around Ring of Honor for as many years as you had, that WrestleMania weekend, it does bring out a lot of new fans who have probably read about Ring of Honor, but this is their first chance getting to experience it live?
Yeah, I think so. I remember especially, for example, when WrestleMania was in Houston a couple of years ago, the building was packed, like, just, you know, filled to capacity, and everybody after the show that would come up and talk to us would say this, a lot of them, it was the first time they get to see Ring of Honor, and they were hooked. So, yeah, I think it's a great opportunity for Ring of Honor and every other wrestling company that runs, you know, because everybody runs, to acquire new fans. And that's why the best thing about it is the fans are here to see wrestling, and they come from all over the world to see it, so...
Your character has just taken off over the last couple of months. First of all, let's talk about the shirt here, Jiu-Jitsu Jack-Off. Yeah. Was that something almost just made up off the top of your head at the last internet pay-per-view? I mean, how did the... Because now you've got the merchandise going, and I think it's going to be a very popular one.
Yeah, I mean, it rolls off the tongue quite nicely. It just kind of came out, and the thing is, you say character took off. It's honestly me. That's the way I am, which I think is why people respond to it so well, because... I don't know. That's just the way I act. That's just the way I think. That's what I say is what I feel. And I think people can relate to that because, you know, who wouldn't want to be able to say what they want and do what they want whenever? And that was a big problem with me and Ring of Honor in the first place, which is part of the reason why I was gone for so long. But, you know, this is the way I am, and they have to take me the way I am because the fans want me this way. So I think that's why I've taken off the way I have. I don't know.
We've seen lots of changes within Ring of Honor over the past year. Now you guys are on Sinclair. Tell us a bit about the adjustment here to television and what you've thought of the product from what you've gotten to see on TV versus just performing live.
To be honest, I don't think that much has changed, really. I mean, we were doing HDNet before Sinclair came along. Everybody's being treated real good, and everybody's, you know, working together as a team. I think the main change is that last year I wasn't there. Mm-hmm. And now I am. And I think that's a big thing for TV because I feel that I bring something that not necessarily other people can't bring, but just don't bring. So I think I think the biggest change, if anything, is me coming back and bringing an element that I think was missing for a while.
May 12th, Ring of Honor is going to be returning to Toronto, Ontario, kind of your stomping ground, so to speak. Yeah. Your neighboring province there of Ontario with Border Wars. Tell us a bit about this show and kind of what it's like getting to go back and perform for Canada for you.
To me, it's probably the biggest show we've ever had, just because every time we come to Toronto, it's a big deal for me, just because it's my homeland, obviously. But everybody's always psyched to go to Toronto because the fans are crazy, and they, again, we pack the building there, and it's always a great experience for everybody. But, you know, this is going to be a big one, and they're promoting it as one of the biggest, if not the biggest, Ring of Honor show ever, and I think it will be, and it's going to be an iPay-per-view, so it could be seen all over the world. And I think that's part of why Toronto's so special, is because they, even, you know, outside of Ring of Honor, for any wrestling whatsoever, even when WWE goes to Toronto, people know it's going to be a hell of a show because the crowd makes it so. So I think that's part of why Toronto's so important to Ring of Honor and every wrestling company that runs there.
It seems that the watching the television every week, it's like the big elusive match is yourself and Davey Richards. And it's really like the crowd is just, we haven't seen it yet, and they're anticipating it. And it seems that is the big match. Is there a chance we might be seeing that as early as May? Or is this something that it could build up even longer?
It could probably build up longer, but I don't want it to. If there's any place I want to do it, it's in Toronto. And that's what I'm doing my best to get it to happen there. So hopefully I'll be successful. And I don't know that there's anybody else Davey could face in Toronto that would be currently, with the way things are in Ring of Honor, that would be better than me, and I don't think I could have a better opponent for Toronto than Davey, so let's hope that happens for sure.
And then after that, we go to the point in time where Steen wins the ROH title in Toronto, and that was the night he defeated Davey Richards for the title. Were you at that show?
Yeah.
Okay, we were both at that show.
Yeah, I shot this interview.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point.
Yeah.
So here's that interview.
All right. We are here with the new Ring of Honor champion, Kevin Steen, outside of the Ted Reeve Arena just moments after his match with Davey Richards. How are you feeling, Kevin?
I'm still sweating and my leg is shot, but I'm the Ring of Honor world champion! So I feel good.
Looks like a lot of people made the trek over here from Quebec. Was there a lot of family and friends in attendance tonight?
Yeah, my parents, my wife, my uncle, my aunt, and actually a lot of wrestlers from back home that I've attended my seminars and I've wrestled with, trained with, and just came up to support me, and I really appreciate it. And let's not forget to mention the other roughly 1,500 Canadians that came out to support me, too.
You guys have to be happy as well. I mean, a very well-attended show tonight at the Ted Reeve Arena. It's going to feel like the whole team here producing tonight and drawing a huge crowd here at the Ted Reeve Arena. The crowd was awesome tonight, I thought.
Yeah, it was awesome. The only thing is, I guess, the iPay-per-view stream had a bit of problem, but that's okay, because as Ring of Honor World Champion, and you can censor this if you want, I will fuck Jim Cornette up if he doesn't get his shit together.
Well, I think the iPay-per-view tonight, we could classify it as a disaster for those at home. But let's hope that they can get things working in order so that everyone can see this match with you,
Buddy,
yourself and Davey.
You want to classify it as a disaster? Just wait till I take over this company as Ring of Honor World Champion. That's going to be a fucking disaster. Thanks, guys.
Thanks a lot, Kevin.
All right. And now we continue.
All right.
What a show that was, Way.
Wow. I mean... Jesus, I've never time traveled mid review. I quite like it. I like this new format.
Well, it's very traumatizing for me to go back and watch my own interviews.
Oh, why?
I hate doing it. Just hate it. So from now we can kind of segue over to the NXT WWE portion.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I mean, there was that PWG match with Johnny Gargano that they made mention
right.
of, and this is where they showed PWG footage.
That's right. You're right. Now that I recall, I got caught here with a review away amateur mistake in that about a month ago this came out and I wanted to watch it. So I did, and I contemplated. I'm like, should I just take notes in case? And I was like, nah. I knew I was taking my break. I was like, we probably won't review this. For now on, I know anything I want to watch out of pleasure, I will regardless take notes. Because I had to go back and rewatch a lot of this when you suggested it, because I thought it would be a good review. But that's the worst when the rare time we watch something and then we decide we're going to review it.
You should take notes for every event in your life, period, because you never know when I'd want to bring it up.
Most things I do take notes.
Just film it.
Yes. So,
this PWG
we did have the
match,
PWG footage, you're right.
Which William Regal was attending, and Kevin Steen at the time really wanted to impress this guy.
Yes. And, okay, this was the most impressive part of the entire documentary. First of all, we'll hear our final Steen interview in a few minutes, but it was WrestleMania weekend in 2015 when he's NXT champion, and I interviewed him, and he told me the story in that interview, which I was limited to like two questions and because I had 2 minutes with him.
Yeah.
And he shared the story that he went to WrestleMania the year before in New Orleans by himself and sat in the crowd. And sure as shit, in this documentary, not only is that story brought up, they find him in the crowd.
Oh, did they? They found a shot of him in the crowd?
You know what? It was one of the extras. I watched it. Someone put the clip up on Twitter. So it was probably an extra we didn't see.
Really?
They found him in the crowd. They are
– how?
Dude,
like,
I don't know.
In WrestleMania?
I don't know. But they're zooming up the seats, and there is Kevin Steen not on his own because sitting next to him is Gabe Sapolsky.
Wow.
This was the greatest find ever.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Like how they found this clip from WrestleMania in a sea of thousands.
I imagine he probably helped out.
Hey. I'm sure maybe he held on to his ticket and could tell them, but how? Like you shot every row of that stadium because maybe you'll need something? Like what are the odds?
Maybe just a wide shot. He happened to
dude, it's a zoom like
really
it is
tight.
Not like you're seeing him way off in the distance.
Oh, okay. Wow. Fascinating. They've done this many times. They've done it with Foley and, of course, Edge.
Did they find Edge in the crowd at WrestleMania 6?
I'm pretty sure I've seen
you're right.
Shot
it's a still
it.
Shot, I think.
Yeah.
Kevin Owens in crowd, WrestleMania 30. I wonder if I can find this clip and show you. But anyway.
Okay.
So
I'll take your word for it. So he gets his WWE tryout match.
Yes.
Here he is, a fellow Canadian, man that has been on the Fight Network many a time. Kevin Owens.
It does feel like it's happened before.
I can't put my finger on it. I believe you had a championship the last time we did interview
well. Wasn't quite as nice, though.
That's a pretty nice one.
I know.
You know, recently you noted it was the one-year anniversary of you coming in to NXT just for...
Actually, it was the one-year anniversary of the first day of my tryout.
Yeah, for the tryout.
Yeah.
So, I mean, here we are, 365 plus days later, NXT champion. I mean, if you had a chance to really sit down and just process what this year has been like for you.
I mean, it's been a really crazy year just because not even just, you know, as far as getting to WWE, but, you know, a little less than a year ago, my wife gave birth to, like, a new daughter, and that was in the midst of us trying to move to Orlando for, you know, WWE and everything. So it's been a really crazy year, but I think being here at Access and, you know, getting to be at WrestleMania really puts things in perspective, because I remember last year I bought a ticket to WrestleMania, and I went by myself to watch the show, and I said it's the last time I'm coming here without WWE paying for me to come here, and now I'm here on their dime as an employee, as a performer, and that's pretty cool. You know, so just thinking back at that, really, I don't know, it's pretty special.
That's really something. Yeah. Now, I know we don't have a lot of time because you have a ton of people here waiting to meet you.
I got my Sharpie and everything.
Tell us quickly just how the knee is doing and what kind of a setback that was. When are you looking to return?
It's doing all right. You know, it's 4 to 6 weeks. Hopefully I'll be back and good to go. It's just, it's one of those things that happen, wear and tear. And, you know, in a way, since I debuted in NXT, I haven't even been 100%. So in a way, it's kind of exciting because now that's fixed. And when I come back, I'm back as myself, so it's going to be even better than it's been, and it's been pretty good so far, so, yeah.
He gets his tryout, and, oh, this footage from the tryout was awesome to see. Like, and you get the sense from here, like, anything in the Performance Center, they film and they archive.
Yes.
All these promo classes, it seems like they have tapes of everything.
Oh, for reasons like this.
Oh, yeah.
Like, completely. I mean, they're filmed. They have the ability in Stanford to just flip a switch, yep, and they can watch them down in Orlando.
Mm-hmm.
And we get some promo work from Kevin Owens.
I love seeing this footage.
Yeah, where he talks about, there was the one clip I saw where it's a heel promo against Sami Zayn. And then we get total babyface Kevin Owens talking about his grandfather, both of his grandfathers who he has their initials, tattooed on his knuckles. Mm-hmm. And it reinforced the fact that I've always believed that down the road, there's a babyface run for Kevin Owens.
If you watch this DVD, you can't help but want to give this guy a huge hug. You know, he'll probably punch you in the face, but like, he comes across like the most likable guy here, talking about his motive. Like, I got emotional many times watching this documentary just because you're brought onto a journey of this guy, wanting this thing so badly, working so hard at it, and then actually achieving it. We all love those human interest stories, and I have no doubt that he'd be a very successful babyface if he wanted to.
Yeah, I was really wishing they had that footage of his son. Remember when his wife recorded?
Yeah, I was in there.
Owens and Cena, that segment with, yeah, his reaction, was that in this?
Yeah, damn, a couple times.
So this has happened like three times now in this documentary. You should be doing this review.
It was probably a month. You've been through a lot since you watched this documentary, I bet.
How about the idea if he had been introduced and had a merchandise line of the Stephen Keen Show?
Oh, God. Stephen Keen.
Or Keller Stevens. Keller Stevens.
Stephen Keen is to me way worse.
They're both awful.
Mr. Keen.
Oh, God. Stephen Keen. Oh, the classic reverse the first letter of the word. Oh, God.
It's Keen.
It's the Stephen Keen Show. and then they come up with Kevin Owens, which was a Hunter suggestion. Yeah. And Kevin states like he just never thought they would okay the term Owen because of Owen Hart, mm-hmm, and the way in which he passed away, which would be a...
Yeah, and at the time, all the litigation.
All the stuff with Martha, like, mm-hmm, they probably would have wanted to steer clear of that. But, I mean, it's a name that, as he states in this, other than Kevin Steen, that, like, it's the name of his son. Yeah. It's a tribute to Owen Hart. And some aren't aware, Owen Hart and Kevin Steen share the same birthday as well.
Oh, wow.
So there's a lot of, on top of the Canadian connection.
Do you know if the two had ever met?
I doubt it because, yeah, I mean, Owen died when he would have been 15 years old.
Yeah, he was before he was in the business, right?
Yeah. And he probably would have had a photo if he had.
Yes.
So, I mean, he was a massive fan. Like, this was a super fan.
You know, I would hire Kevin Owens to document my life.
Yeah, he was, hey, gathers up. It paid off with this documentary, yeah, all that.
You know what? Maybe his dad is who, he's probably the one who.
I want to know who was filming his dad chopping in the crowd.
IWS, wasn't it? Wasn't that from an IWS show?
Yeah, so I guess it was, well, it was like some handheld in the crowd. Yeah. So.
All right, so we move up to, so he's in NXT and they tell him, don't get your hopes up.
Yeah, it's amazing how many barriers were just thrown in front of this guy. Like, first of all, it was the long trip just to get into the company.
Yeah.
And then it's with, yeah, you're, oh, this is it. This is the end of the line for you. It's NXT.
But honestly, at the time, I feel like many onlookers as fans felt we had the same impressions. And this doesn't just go for Kevin Owens, but I think Samoa Joe, you can look at maybe, was maybe put under the same microscope. Maybe even Johnny Gargano and Tommaso Ciampa.
Bobby Roode right now.
Right. Who were brought in, and Asuka, I have no doubt Asuka will be brought up now, but at the time, who would have known how long they would have lasted?
I don't look at anyone as being exclusive. In a company that changes their mind on a whim. Mm-hmm. I think it's impossible to look at anyone mm-hmm. as not being eligible for the main roster. Yeah. And I'll say the night Owens debuted, I think just him walking out, it felt really important. And by the end of that night where he did the attack on Zayn, it's like, this guy needs to be.
Oh, he's a top star already.
He felt like a top guy instantly.
It really is incredible when you look at it from like a kind of a bird's eye view of all the events, how quickly he ascended once he got through the doors of the company, going basically getting the complete fast track through NXT onto the main roster into a top program with Cena. And I think a lot of that speaks to just how talented he is, how talented he was the moment he walked in through the door. He was already way more talented than many of the people in the main roster.
And you just look at what could have happened if they just had, they talk about the Cena Open Challenge, and Owens even did in promo class in NXT cut a promo on Cena to confront him at that Montreal Raw. And then they said, hey, we're going with your idea, but it's going to be Zayn.
Yeah.
That's the match where he blows out his shoulder. Yeah. It's like, if you reverse that and that's Owens just coming in and losing to Cena that night, maybe it's a totally different path.
Yeah, good point.
They probably wouldn't have. He was also NXT champion at that time.
Yeah.
So maybe that was the reason they decided to go with Zayn instead.
But again, I think it's interesting, like, to know this man's mindset. I think he's always thinking about how he can get noticed, even when he got into NXT, especially when he got into NXT, and taking on an opportunity to cut a promo in front of Michael Cole or whoever was coming up from
the Luminaries,
in order to put into their minds the idea that, hey, maybe you should call me up right away. And they didn't listen to him right away, but they ultimately did listen to him. And so this man, like, essentially kind of wrote his own ticket to the main roster when he probably could have stayed there a lot longer if he wasn't such a go-getter.
Yeah, and he even shares the story that when he got signed, he uprooted his family to move from Montreal to Orlando, and he told his wife, I'll be on the main roster in 6 months as kind of reassurance. And, I mean, to himself, he was thinking, like, he's making a big promise here. And he made it in 6 months.
Yeah.
And he got to move back home.
Yeah. So then fast forward to the time when he shows up to WrestleMania as NXT champion, and some great footage. I don't know how long they had been working on this Kevin Owens DVD, but man, they followed this man throughout. They had footage on him almost, it felt like, his entire time that he was in the WWE. And that includes his walking around the backstage area and Hulk Hogan running into Kevin Owens.
Hogan's been very complimentary of Owens publicly.
Then NXT champion and putting him over huge.
Yeah.
The Rock walking up to him and putting him over huge. And it's amazing footage, because here you have The Rock, you have Hulk Hogan, you have Stone Cold Steve Austin later on pumping this guy's tires on camera. And like, I'm almost positive in these instances, Owens was just like downplaying his reaction to the camera. Like, the way Owens reacted was like, oh yeah, thanks. But like, meanwhile, like, I know the fan with the Chris Jericho poster on his wall was probably freaking out inside.
Yeah. Know? We also, going back to his call up and then hearing the story that Vince McMahon told him to be in his gear tonight for the Cena Open Challenge, and Steen asking, he was told, don't tell anybody. He's like, well, they're all going to see me in my gear. What happens if they ask what I'm doing? And Vince tells him, well, tell them to go fuck themselves.
I love that.
All right. And then we get the story of how he's in catering and Rollins walks up to him and he's eating a steak with his knife and fork and is asking what he's here for. And I mean, this is the guy that never thought Owens would get in the door. And Owens is now, he's been signed and he's like, I'm getting called up. And he's like, really?
What do you do? His reaction was more like silent, because as he was eating steak.
And then he's like, what are you doing? He's like, yeah, I'm working with Cena. And he throws his utensils up in the air like he's just stunned at this.
Yeah. Amazing.
It's kind of crazy that it's
– but it's not – I don't think – to me, I don't take it as like, wow, what a jerk, right? No, I think – okay, in some ways, Seth Rollins is presented as Kevin Owens' biggest detractor, but he's only his biggest detractor because he's such a good friend and he's extra hard on him because he has his own perception of why he was hired and what it takes to be successful.
But at what point is your line of thinking been contradicted with reality? He's got in his own way.
I would say now.
Like the last thing I would ever want if I'm a Seth Rollins is 50 other Seth Rollins clones. I mean,
I don't think that's what he wants. I think that's what he thinks was his ticket into the door. The fact that he looks like the way he does, you know, the fact that he's in the shape that he is actually in. And he wanted Owens to get in the door as well. And he thought that was the only way. And obviously Rollins has been proven wrong at this point.
Yeah. And, you know, you look at it now and it's, you know, that was a big stumbling block for Owens all those years. And now you look at it and it's
still is for some guys, you know,
for some. But like, to me, it's the promos that are, I think when you go to a Hogan or a Rock or an Austin, I think that's probably what draws them to Owens the most is that this guy is a world class promo.
Yeah.
And it's in an era where they're few and far between, I think, at that elite level.
Yes.
That used to be a requisite for the job for those top guys.
And it really is amazing how fast he moved up. And being put into that program with Cena, I think we were all surprised by. But the fact that he beat Cena, too, at the pay-per-view was incredible. I think it shows you the confidence they had in him, like, behind the scenes. Here's a man, like, who talks really big, but, like, in-ring, standing next to Cena, he comes across like an equal. He made that NXT championship look like an equal to John Cena. And I mean, it takes a great deal of confidence in order to pull that off.
Yeah. And then you fast forward and you
IC get title run.
The IC title run, he had the US title run as well. Preceding that, they show him at WrestleMania.
Was he US champion before that?
Well, with Cena. He won the title briefly.
Did he?
Well, he beat him the first night, right?
Did he win the title, though?
You're right. It was a non-title. Yeah, maybe he didn't win the U.S. title.
I forget. It was a long time ago. Maybe he didn't.
He would win the U.S. title eventually.
Yeah.
So anyway.
So IC title, whatever. My favorite moment, though, in this whole documentary was WrestleMania 32. They had cameras on him as he walked through kind of the empty arena to kind of soak in the atmosphere. But my favorite, like, scene in the whole thing, he's in the back walking on his way to the ring for his match, Money in the Bank ladder match IC title ladder match.
Yep.
And on this walk, keep in mind, like, in the hour that we've been following this guy, we've seen him fall in love with wrestling after watching WrestleMania 11 and then work essentially stumbled his entire way over 12 years to get into the company. So here he is backstage about to have his WrestleMania debut match. Last year, this guy was watching in the stands. Here this year or 2 years ago, he's watching in the stands. 2 years later, he's in the show. He's in the back walking. He's shaking hands with Scott Hall, Sean Waltman. He's asking Scott Hall for advice for the ladder match he's about to have at WrestleMania. Like, as a kid, you know, who grew up watching wrestling, like, how that's crazy. It's like what an amazing moment is that? That, and then he walks to Gorilla and he sees Stone Cold Steve Austin, who was the guy who he asked for advice at the airport. So, like, and then he goes out and has the match. But to me, like, this walk from behind the scenes to the front that they captured on camera was almost like a dream sequence, you know, for this guy. That I think you could have ended the documentary on that. But, like, there's obviously more to tell with his story, too.
And the final thing we can talk about, which I don't know when filming wrapped for this, but of course, there's the Universal title win, which Pat brings this up in the interview too, which is really interesting of like where this goes if Finn Balor isn't injured.
Yeah.
Where Owens goes after that. I mean, probably a mid-card feud with I mean, the Jericho stuff, they went hard with after SummerSlam. They teamed together, so they already had the association, but that's probably, you know, a secondary title feud. Maybe they feud over a secondary title. Maybe they team for a while, but certainly not the level of focus that it ended up becoming with those two. So in Finn Balor's absence, I mean, Owens really benefited.
Completely.
And that's another thing on just the timing of everything. So
timing is everything.
Overall, anything else that we didn't touch on?
I'm trying to think if there are any bonus things that, I mean, just a lot of great little vignettes. I think
the stuff on his tattoos with his grandfather with the Superstar Inc. segment was very good.
Everything was really strong. So I urge everybody to not only check out the documentary, but the bonus features as well. I thought it was a really strong documentary. It really captured this guy's long road to where he is currently, a good profile of his personality and his passion and motivation. Great, just such a thorough presentation of all the footage from this guy's life, you know, between his career to his training to his child's reactions to him wrestling John
Cena. Which
were
in the documentary.
Yes.
You know who I wanted to hear from? I was surprised his wife wasn't interviewed. She's such a big part of his story, and he constantly talks about her.
Right.
Maybe she didn't want to be interviewed because that just seemed like a natural of someone you would expect to have heard from in all of this. Yeah. And she's shown, but not interviewed.
But like the amount of footage that I think WWE themselves has seemingly filmed of not just him, but I imagine everybody that they have hired. It gives me a lot of like high hopes for future documentaries, you know? Like I think about the future, I don't know, Enzo and Cass documentary, for instance. I'm sure they already have a ton in the bank.
Enzo got credit for his gear.
You're right. Yes.
He was wearing a singlet. He had bought a singlet for NXT because he thought he had to ditch his old look. And Enzo told him, like, what are you wearing that for? Mm-hmm. They hired you to be you. You're supposed to be, and he ended up getting a t-shirt and using Finn Balor's face paint or body paint to write fight. And I mean, that's a look like the singlet to me would not have been.
We saw him train in the singlet in the performance center. It's just, yeah, he looked like
this
an indie.
This is not him.
He looked like an indie guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, I really enjoyed this. It's a different era that the WWE focuses on that I think a lot of people will have a lot of interest in, whether you have followed Kevin Steen's career pre-WWE or not. At this time, we're going to hear from Pat LaProde, who's been a longtime friend and covered Kevin Steen going back to his early days on the Quebec independent scene, to dive a bit deeper into that section of his career. And it's a bit of a lengthy interview, and then at the end of things, Wei and I will come back to read your feedback and also let you know what we're reviewing in 2 weeks' time. So here he is, noted author and friend of the show, Pat LaProde, on Review Away. We have done our review of the WWE's recent release of the Fight Owens Fight documentary, and as I was watching this, I knew the man I had to call, almost like picking up the bat phone, which I will call the Pat phone. Pat LaProde is with us. Noted author. We're going to go through all of his projects that are out, but always happy to have him on the show. Pat, how are you doing today?
Very good. Very good. Yourself?
This was certainly a documentary that had a lot of anticipation behind it. And also, you get with a lot of WWE releases. So many of them are focused on a certain generation of talent, a lot of focus on the Monday Night War. And this is a departure from that. And it's kind of the next generation of performers and their stories coming up. You are someone that probably knows Kevin Steen as good as anyone that has covered him. I want to go back with you. When Kevin Steen was first on your radar in the early 2000s, can you recall first hearing the name and whatever buzz he was starting to accumulate?
Yeah, I started being involved and following the indie scene in Montreal, in the province of Quebec, in September of 2001. And, I mean, soon after, I started hearing the name of Kevin Steen, because there was a show that as we all know, Kevin was wrestling for Jacques Rougeau at the time. And there was a three-way match that he has done, I believe it was in 2001. It could be early 2002, for Jacques Rougeau. And one of the guy who was following, you know, a lot of promotion, promotions had seen the match, and he was the only one from the little group of people who were, you know, going to promotion to various promotions in the province of Quebec. He was the only one who went to that Rougeau show, and he was just raving about that match. If I recall correctly, it was Kevin against Handsome JF against Max Boyer. I can be wrong, but I do believe it was the match. And he kept raving and raving about that match, and especially Kevin's performance. The first time that I saw Kevin wrestle was only in February of 2004, because I was involved in a promotion in Montreal where, for some odd reason, they didn't allow its talent to go see other promotions.
Mm-hmm.
I learned a lot at that promotion, but at the same time wasn't allowed to go somewhere else. And for some reason, I just listened to what I've been told. So I wasn't going anywhere else. So I didn't see Kevin's early matches with the IWS at the time. His match with Matty69 XS that he's talking on the documentary, the very first IWS match, he wrestled that. It was in September of 2003, and I didn't see that match. I had friends who went and who kept telling me about Kevin. But the first match is when I got out of that promotion, and that very same weekend, Kevin was wrestling Rick Martel's nephew, Kevin Martel, another Kevin, who was at the time with XS probably the best two talent in the province of Quebec that, you know, were doing the tour and wrestling, you know, for various promotions. And Kevin, you know, the XS and Kevin Martel were the two matchups that a lot of promoters wanted Kevin Steen to have, because, you know, it was like dream matches in Quebec at the time. And I've seen one of those matches with both Kevin, and I was like, wow, this guy is really incredible. And I do remember vividly that the first year in 2004, there's not one match that I saw Kevin doing, doing a bad move and doing something like, you know, people will start chanting, you effed up. It never happened to Kevin. Everything he was doing looked easy. He was doing a 450, and it just looked so easy on him. And I was, like, very, very amazed by his performance. And 2004 was really a big breakout year for Kevin in the province of Quebec. And that's also when he got his first match in the United States.
You know, from the guys you have spoken with and you know, been around for all this time, how is Jacques Rougeau's reputation as a trainer? I mean, are there would Kevin Steen go back and at least look at the training elements with Jacques as a positive for him, or did he not necessarily have that reputation? Because in the documentary, it seems like his shows, they were very planned out, very structured. But how was the training reputation?
Well, I can only tell you what other people have been telling me, right? Because I've never been trained by Jacques Rougeau. I've never been trained by Jacques Rougeau myself. It depends which period. From what I understand, it depends which period you were at Jacques Rougeau's school at the time. Kevin was there at a time where Jacques was training himself, but by the end of his by the end of 2003, and Kevin was still with Rougeau and everything. There was another student of Jacques, one of his first students, Eric Mastrocola, who started training a little bit. And there was Pierre Carwellet, who was involved with Jacques at the time, who was training, helping Jacques training as well. So it depends who you talk to. It depends when that person was in Jacques' school. Jacques trained some of them. Some other people trained some other people as well. So I mean, it's tough for me to, I can only say what, you know,
right.
Whatever Kevin has said on the DVD, he told me this a long time ago, that he really started learning, more and more, you know, when he got out of Jacques, because Jacques was showing him one way to do the things he wanted him to do. And it was always, you know, because of the match he was going to have. You know, it wasn't always well, this is how generally this is done in wrestling. Well, this is what you're going to do. I recall something, okay, that I'm not sure if Kevin said that in the documentary, but usually when you take someone in a headlock, you're supposed to put the footing you're supposed to have is supposed to have your head close to the other wrestler's head so you can call him a move, mm-hmm. right? Because that's where, you know, you take him in a headlock, you're going to call him something, you're going to whip him, on the ropes and do whatever you just called. But Jacques, the way he was training his students, is you had to keep your head away from the other people's head because he didn't want the crowd to think that you were talking to each other.
Right.
But in reality, that's not how it's done, you know? So Kevin had to change the way his footing when he was doing a headlock when he started wrestling on the indie scene because of that. So that's just one thing I remember Kevin telling me at the time. I don't remember if he tells that in the documentary, but it goes in the same way of what he's saying, you know?
It's definitely touched upon in the documentary, but they don't go into a whole lot of depth regarding his time with IWS, which I'd certainly get the impression, and I didn't get to see him really performing at that time in IWS, but that seems to be a promotion that really helped develop him. They've got in the extras this tremendous promo of his on camera when he's going over the decision of whether to sign this 10-year deal with Jacques and get this hypothetical dark match in the WWE, but having to give up IWS. I assume that promotion was, just talk to us a bit about IWS and its role within the Quebec scene and cultivating the talent it did.
Yeah, I have to admit that when I watched the documentary at first, I was like, eh, they didn't talk that much about the Quebec indie scene, you know? And then when I watched the extras, there was so more stuff about his early days in Quebec. And that made me in peace with the documentary, you know? So that's why I would suggest anyone to actually watch both the documentary and the extras, because you really get the full portrait of Kevin's career when you match the two. That dark match that Kevin was talking about, it was the talk of the town at the time. I remember that very much, you know? Everybody knew that Jacques had made public that, you know, he was going to send two of his guys to a future dark match, and that he would choose, you know, Kevin and Eric Mastrocola. And I remember my first encounter with Kevin, I sent him a message on one of the message boards for Quebec Wrestling to congratulate him about getting a dark match. At the time I didn't know that, you know, there were conditions for him not, you know, to stay on the indie scene or stay with the IWS or anything like that. And the dark match, just for your record, that thing happened. It happened May 31st, 2004. There was a Raw in Montreal, the same Raw where Sylvain Grenier and Robert Conway won the tag team titles over Edge and Chris Benoit. And there were a Sunday Night Heat taping, and there's actually two students of Jacques, Eric Mastrocola and Ensemble JF, who got a match on Heat against Rosie and Hurricane. So that match happened at some point. So that Jacques wasn't talking bullshit here. That really happened.
Yeah, I guess it was Steen's kind of. He just wasn't aware was this going to happen or
exactly.
Not. And that was his conflict.
Oh no, exactly. When he took his decision, there were no date. That nothing was announced yet. The run in Montreal wasn't even announced. So yeah, I mean, but it finally happened. And IWS, I mean, that's really the first promotion where Kevin started wrestle regularly. And that's actually where he got his nickname of Mr. Wrestling. People think that, you know, he named himself Mr. Wrestling, which was not the case. People, you know, just by seeing him wrestle, started chanting Mr. Wrestling, and that's how he got his nickname. And he put it on his very first t-shirt that he started selling, and the name was made, you know, from then on. There's actually two promotions in Quebec who played a big, big role in Kevin's early development. IWS, of course, which was at the time one of the top two companies in the province of Quebec, because, you know, they give him, you know, dream matches against XF. I remember in December of 2003, there was a three-way match between him, Generico, and Pierre-Carl Ouellet, which was voted match of the year or among the best match of the year in the province of Quebec. And so, you know, there was a lot of talent in the IWS, and they were switching guards. You know, they were becoming more and more a very good wrestling promotion when maybe back in 2001, 2002, they were more known for their hardcore style. And now with guys like Kevin, XS, Generico, PCO, they were leaving a little of that hardcore edge they had towards more, you know, work rate matches with those guys. The other promotion was EWR, mm-hmm. who was only short-lived, only lasted a year and 9 months. It was in Quebec City, but that's where Kevin started to wrestle against indie, quote-unquote, stars. In April of 2004, there was a match between Kevin and Christopher Daniels. That's the very first big match Kevin had against an American here in Quebec, well, anywhere for that matter. And soon after, in the year and a half that followed, that's where he wrestled Steve Corino. That's where he wrestled AJ Styles. He got a tag team match, him and Christopher Daniels against AJ Styles and XS. He got a lot of opportunities in the EWR. He wrestled P.T. Williams. P.T. Williams was one of the regulars at EWR. Generico was one of the regulars as well. So those two promotions really did a lot for Kevin. But you got also to know that at the time, Kevin was the hottest commodity in town. Every promoter that was bringing a guy from the U.S. wanted Kevin to wrestle against. He wrestled against Jerry Lynn. And I think it was Jerry Lynn, Kevin. There was a three-way between him, Generico, and Lufisto, I think. And the winner was against Jerry Lynn. He wrestled against Samoa Joe. There was a guy who did just a big all-star show in Quebec, and he brought Samoa Joe when he was Ring of Honor champion, and Kevin wrestled him. He wrestled Austin Aries for the Ring of Honor title in early 2005 for that same promotion. I mean, it, everywhere. Jamie Noble wrestled Kevin during that time as well in Quebec. He got to wrestle all these guys who were more experienced, who had a name on the indie scene, and so he got a lot of opportunities throughout the province of Quebec, but definitely IWS and EWR were the top two.
When it comes to the promos and the personality, was that something evident from your early impressions of Kevin Steen? Was it something that he got more comfortable with? How would you describe that, which is such a huge part of his presentation?
It's funny because I remember, I mean, he was doing a lot of promo in French at the time because, you know, most of the promotions he was working for were, you know, French promotions, you know, contrary to the IWS was more English. And I remember talking to a few people and we're like, you know, Kevin is not that great. He's like amazing in the ring, but he's kind of just an okay promo, not more than that, you know. I don't know if it was because in French you couldn't, you know, sometimes wrestling is just easier in English than it is in French because everything, you know, is everything is called in English, you know, so sometimes maybe it's easier. But I remember that back in 2004, 2005, even maybe 2006, early 2006, that I was talking about other people in the business in Quebec and we're not that impressed with Kevin's skills as a promo. That's something that he developed, at least to me, you know, with my eyes. That's something that he improved so much, you know, as the years went by. I mean, it was amazing. And I mean, it's not even mentioned in the documentary, but Kevin's first run in Ring of Honor didn't last that long. He started in February in a do or die show. And by the end of August, him and Generico were cut from the roster. Gabe didn't see anything in them where he wanted to keep them on the main roster. it was a very strong roster, you know, at the time. You know, the Punk was still there, and Joe and Reeve and a lot of guys. But they were cut. And that's when PWG became their top promotion to work for. And they continued to make a name for themselves. Kevin went to Japan that was in 2005, the first Ring of Honor run. Kevin went to Japan after that. And they started working, you know, all the other indies, including PWG. So much that, I believe it was in February of 2007, they got a second chance to Ring of Honor in a tight team match against the Briscoes, and it was in Philly. I was at that match. I was at that show, actually. And they just, you know, had this incredible match. And that's when they really, started making a name for themselves in Ring of Honor. And, you know, that kept going for many years after that.
I wanted to ask you as well about the big CZW four-way that Zane and Steen really credit as their breakthrough, their gateway into the U.S. from 2004. And today, a big match like that happens. You can probably watch the match within 24 hours, given all the outlets you have. 2004, it's a bit of a different time period. Was that a match that instantly trickled back to Quebec and there was a big buzz on the match? Was it as big for the people back home as it was for the performers?
Perhaps not. Mm-hmm. Because you had to buy the DVD from CCW to watch the match, right?
Yeah.
But I remember that summer, Sexy Eddie was making a killing for CCW. And Kevin talks about that in the documentary where he did that death match and he started bleeding from the arm and he went crazy. And that footage was seen a lot on the different message boards in Quebec. So we knew Eddie, you know, was starting to get a buzz, with CZW. And CZW and IWS have been doing business for a long time. You know, back in 2001, 2002, guys like Justice Payne and Lobo were wrestling for IWS at the time, you know, one or two times a year, and IWS were sending a few of their guys to CZW. And, but the territory was very close, you know. Before 2004, there were not a lot, Justice Payne and Lobo were probably the biggest, the two biggest names that the indie scene had seen from the United States. And very, very few guys from here were wrestling in the United States. And 2004, that all changed with EWR bringing, you know, more and more, guys like Daniels and Styles and all those guys, Corino and other promotion doing the same. And guys like Kevin, Generico and Excess starting to wrestle in the United States as well. But that match, CZW wanted to get more from this IWS promotion, because of Sexy Eddie. And I remember that it was a guy named Michael Ryan, known in the wrestling community as Lacor, who unfortunately passed away.
Yes.
Before Kevin made it to WWE. And, he's the one who suggested, well, you know, we could send Kevin, Generico, and Excess and have a four-way match. And that was Borden match of the year in CZW.
Uh-huh.
So that's just amazing. From time to time, I still watch, at least once a year, I still watch this match. Cause I think it was just, you know, just for the importance of it. And I was happy that both, Sammy and Kevin were mentioning it in the documentary. Cause that match really made them in the U.S. Super Dragon. I think that because of that match, they got a booking at Jersey All Pro. Super Dragon was at the show. He got them booked in PWG, and that's, you know, when the ball started rolling. And everywhere Kevin was wrestling, Generico was with him, you know. Throughout the documentary, we see things about, you know, this is Harbell, you know, when Sammy got signed, it was like if both of them, you know, were signed. And it was true, you know, they were like two twins who never leave each other, you know. Every promotion wanted to book either Kevin against Generico or both of them teaming together. And it was not only in Quebec, but it became a reality, you know, as well. The first match they got in PWG was against each other, right? So I mean, that match was really, really important. But in Quebec, unless you bought the DVD, you are not necessarily aware of it. Or, you know, it was, you know, on the message boards. It wasn't, social medias were not what it is today as well. You know, you couldn't connect as easily maybe that you can on Facebook nowadays or Twitter or stuff like that. So it was another era, but definitely that match was important for them.
I think one of the strongest parts of this whole documentary is just not only the fact that they were able to work out the deal to get so much ROH footage, but just that so much of Kevin's pre-ROH work, it was filmed, that was put on camera, that I feel we're going to see more and more over the next number of years, because all of these guys are getting their stuff recorded, and it's not – and it makes the documentary so much stronger when you can see a young Kevin Steen cutting these promos, working in IWS. And that to me was a big strength overall. And I don't think if they didn't have the ROH footage in there, that's probably a period of his career that's glossed over within 5 minutes.
No, you're right. But I mean, and I think that's why I was happy with the extras, because the extras with the IWS, there's like a chapter in the extras about IWS, and there's a lot more that you can see about Kevin in his early days in Montreal than you actually see in the documentary, you know? And there's even more Ring of Honor stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, most of his career, he spent it outside of WWE, you know? But at the same time, you don't get to, I think the documentary lasts an hour, 60 minutes or so.
Yeah.
And you don't get to WWE before what? Two-thirds of the documentary, maybe? So it's still representative of, you know, somewhat representative of what his career was, you know, because it's not even, I mean, is it 2 years now that he's on the main roster? I mean, it's WWE career skyrocketed so fast, but at the same time, it's not like he's there for 10 years. You know, he's been, you know, that promo with John Cena when he says to John that he's probably been wrestling for longer than him. I mean, he wrestled for 15 years on those, you know, on the indie scene, or 14 years or close to 15. So I was still happy with the end result in this. I mean, it's a very good documentary. I'm very, very happy. And I have really not much to say against the documentary. And, you know, I was glad that at least, you know, it wasn't like, WWE days took, 45 minutes out of 60 and the rest were only explained in 15 minutes. And when you add the extras, it's even more, you know. So I was happy about that.
I really wish that they had put Jim Cornette in this. I mean, he had just been there Mania weekend, and they went out of their way to make that post Final Battle 2010 period. I mean, that was the lowest point of his career, and I think it would have been a great subject to have the counterpoint, because I always feel with Steen and Cornette, I never have bought that Cornette saw nothing in this guy. I think that his execution of how to utilize him was where the sides didn't meet and are on different pages philosophically. But I do see that Cornette did see this guy, if he could make certain changes, could be he was the ROH champion under Cornette's booking. And I would have liked to have heard Cornette in this documentary.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if he was asked or if he just, you know, decided against it. I don't know. That's a subject. I mean, I've met Jim a few times. I was around Ring of Honor when Jim was booking. I've been interviewed by Jim, and I mean, that's a subject that I I just decided not to talk about, you know, for obvious reasons, you know. I mean, I don't agree how Kevin I don't agree with how Jim was seeing Kevin at the time. He had his reasons. Don't want to get into it, because, you know, that's really between Kevin and him. And, you know, I only heard one version of the whole, you know, version of Kevin, of course. never really talk about it to Jim. So I don't know, but you know, from what I know, well, yeah, I didn't really agree the way Kevin was treated with Ring of Honor. And I think he simply proved them wrong. You know, when I was there in June, when he came back, you know, the footage we see that, you know, he comes back from, you know, in the middle of the crowd on the balcony at Hammerstein Ballroom. I mean, the place just exploded that day. And I remember he kind of put Kairi Sulkin into a package pile driver, but, you know, he got out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the place going crazy for that, you know. And I think that's when probably Kevin realized that the fans didn't forget about him, and the fans wanted him there. And anyone involved with Ring of Honor at the time would have been a fool not seeing that. And he never left after that. You know, they never told him to take a break or to come back in 6 months or to, you know, get in shape or anything like that, you know. And I mean, even Cornette, you know, even with Generico, I mean, Cornette in some interviews said that he did ask Generico to wrestle without his mask.
Yeah.
And Generico refused to do that, rightfully so, if you ask me. And then Jim said something like, when he started as Sami Zayn, he said something like, oh, well, you know, now that he's being asked by WWE, he decided, you know, against wrestling with his mask. But that's two different things, you know. Ring of Honor wasn't paying him enough to get rid of his gimmick that was getting him booked through 29 countries around the world. WWE was another ballgame, you know. So, I mean, I don't know, you know, there's a lot of stuff that probably I don't even know. And that, you know,
this could be its own spin-off documentary, Pat.
I'm sorry?
I was going to say this could be its own documentary they could release down the road.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. Definitely. If the two could sit together like you know, like Brett and Sean could.
Right.
Years later, you know, that's something I'd be interested in hearing for sure.
I also feel that time period, as much as it must have been a very difficult one for Steen at the time, I would be curious if in hindsight he looks at that, because to me that was some of the best performers at times face that adversity, and it builds up a chip on your shoulder that is that confidence. And Steen talking about walking out on Raw, he wasn't nervous because he felt he deserved there, that sometimes those hardships are really big confidence builders for the best performers of a generation, which I think a lot of people can look at Steen as one of those dynamic performers.
As much talent as he had in his early days in Quebec, as much amazing I thought he was, when he came back from Japan, he spent a few months in Japan. I think Jack Evans was there as well at the time. And that's about the same time that he met Stone Cold at the airport, and he told him to, you know, never stop running his mouth. I've seen Kevin, I mean, and I had that discussion with Kevin many times, and he don't think I'm right, but, it, you know, with my own eyes, I could see Kevin was a different wrestler. That, you know, as good as he was just even better. And not only was he fluid doing all the moves he was, but the whole psychology, his promo, he was getting into a total package kind of wrestler, you know. And I think that showed a lot when he came back to Ring of Honor. That showed a lot when he wrestled in PWG. And he became that guy that, wow, you know, I if I have a promotion, I have to book this guy. And I have to book this guy on top. This guy is money, you know. And I think that's at that time after Japan and that encounter with Stone Cold, that Kevin, like, he switched gear. And there's a point, I guess, in every wrestler's career where, you know, you have that meeting with someone, or something happens, or that, you know, you're going to switch gears and get into something else that will, you know, get you down the road to be main eventing Ring of Honor or getting you signed by WWE. And I believe that's the focus point. You know, that point arrived there around 2006, 2007 for Kevin.
So as a guy that has followed him, covered him for as long as you have, Pat, and your cameo in this documentary is during his debut on the NXT roster. It's December 11th.
Twice, actually. I'm cameo, not during his NXT debut. It's the NXT match in Brooklyn when he had that ladder match with Finn Balor. I'm standing next to his dad. But also, I think it's in the extras, you see Kevin and Generico wrestle in a shitty bar in Montreal named Bogey's World. And you see his dad chopping Generico. And I'm just...
I have to go back and watch. I missed you in that
shot. Well, I'm the guy with the white T-shirt in the back. That's because Kevin's dad's name is Terry. And I'm the guy who started the chant of Terry, Terry. And I completely forgot about that moment until I saw it on the documentary. And I was like, wow, that's so funny. And I do remember now, you know, being there. And you know, I couldn't believe that these two guys were, you know, wrestling in front of, I don't know, there were maybe not even, I don't know, 60, 70 people. And you know, it was such a bad venue. And that's always the match that, you know, it was one of the matches when I saw them wrestle at in Dallas, you know, in front of, I don't know, 90,000-something people. And when I was saying, you know, well, I watched them wrestle in front of 60 people, and now they're like, or 90 people, and now they're 90,000 people. That's, you know, one of the matches that I remembered from that period.
If I were to have told you in 2013 of what the landscape would be like in 2017, I mean, were you always of the belief that Steen would eventually get that call, or did you just feel he was going to be one of those guys that, much like a Christopher Daniels, makes a good living, but it will be outside of WWE?
2013, yes, because Generico has just been signed. So
right.
To me, if one would get the call, I didn't see why the other wouldn't get the call. And I was actually arguing with some friends of mine who were like, oh no, you know, Kevin doesn't have the shape they're looking for, doesn't have the body they're looking for, and he'll never get signed. It's like, you're all wrong. You know, this thing is switching in WWE, and Generico was just one of them. So I couldn't believe that Kevin would have never got that call. But if you tell me 2012, I don't know, in the summer of 2012, I'm not sure I would have give any hope to both Generico and Kevin.
Yeah, I think Punk and the Shield. I think that those were, and probably Punk and Brian were pretty much at the front of that.
Danielson and Punk, I do believe, were the first two who really made people in WWE to realize that indie guys knew how to work, could adapt to that so-called WWE style, and were able to draw money to main event shows and to do very, very well in WWE. And then you got Claudio Cesaro, who came in and did well. And then you had Seth Rollins and Dean Ambrose with The Shield, who were coming from the indie scene. You know, Roman Reigns wasn't coming from the indie scene as much, but both Ambrose and Rollins, yes. And so I think these guys should be credited with you know, all those indie guys that got signed after that, because I do believe that they made the important people in WWE to realize that indie guys, you know, could be hired and could do well. But I mean, would have, even in 2013, even when he got signed, you would have told me that he would, you know, do that streak of pay-per-views. Because Kevin, I don't know if you know that, but Kevin hasn't missed one pay-per-view since he's been brought up to the main roster. That's a streak that is, like, almost unheard of.
Huh.
So there's very, very few wrestlers who are, and I think Kurt Angle is one of them, or is last. He has a record in WWE, you know, with a streak of pay-per-views from the beginning. of his career, but he's one of the best in that category. And I mean, Universal Champion, three times US Champion, two times IC Champion, one time NXT. I mean, even the fact that he was promoted to the main roster after 6 months. And there's a very, very good extra about that 6 month thing on the documentary where, you know, he told his wife, you know, don't worry, we won't be here more than,
yeah,
we won't be in Orlando more than 6 months. And I remember him telling me that he told his wife about that. And I was like, well, you know, 6 months is a short period of time, you know? And you know, somehow he made it, you know? Everywhere he was, I mean, from 2010, 2011, everywhere Kevin was going, he made it work. You know, he main evented everywhere. And by the end of his indie career, he was known as, you know, as much as Mr. Wrestling as he was the king of indies. Everybody wanted to have Kevin. Everybody wanted to put their championship title on Kevin. And you know, he got signed and just continued on that amazing streak. You know, he had started on the indies.
I just wonder if the Kevin Owens show would have been usurped by an even bigger marketing campaign with the Keller Stevens show, if that had been his. I mean, that some phenomenal names that were throwing out his way.
I mean, I don't have it anymore, but I do remember Kevin sending me a list of names and asking me my opinion about it. And I mean, there were not one name that came close to Kevin Owens. But at the same time, he didn't know at the time that he could, you know, use the name Kevin,
right,
or use the name Owen. So he was trying to work around that. But he actually sent me, I remember seeing the list that he sent WWE. There were 10 names on it. And there were not one name that was like as good as Kevin Owens. But, you know, thankfully, he was able to use the name and you know, that's as, like you said, you know, that's as close as Kevin Steen as he could have got.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. Just kind of there's so many just perfect timing for so many things where it's just one slight change here. It could have been such a different direction of certain things. And it's definitely a documentary I recommend. We'll end this off here, Pat.
But John, yeah. I just want to add something. You know, in wrestling, it's always about timing.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen that with so many wrestlers, and I mean, even his Universal title run was about timing. You know, what if Finn doesn't get injured?
Sure.
You know, what happens to Kevin and how he would have been booked, you know? And the same goes for many other wrestlers. So wrestling is all about timing, and, you know, it's about talent and timing, and you know, Kevin had, you know, both during his tenure so far with WWE.
Well, I want to give you the floor here, Pat, because you have many things that you can talk about. I will definitely recommend, if you've enjoyed our chat about the Quebec wrestling scene and its entire history, Mad Dogs, Midgets, and Screwjobs is an essential read from Pat and Bertrand Hibert. But many other projects out, and just let us know, Pat, where people can go catch both your most recent release and an English version that is coming out later this fall.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the Mad Dogs, Midgets, and Screwjobs book. There's also Sisterhood of the Squared Circle, the History and Rise of Women's Wrestling that I co-wrote with PWI senior editor, senior writer Dan Murphy, the whole history of women's wrestling. In September 5th, the biography of Maurice Mad Dog Vachon, called Mad Dog, the Maurice Vachon story, will hit the stands. Bookstores, Amazon, everywhere. So that's September 5th. Probably we'll talk about it when it gets out. And I want to mention also the DVDs that me and Bertrand, have produced over the years. There's four DVD set, 4 hours each about the best of Quebec wrestling throughout the years. We have stuff from the 50s, from the 70s, from Grand Prix wrestling, even All-Star Wrestling, Raymond Rougeau was able to find some gems in his basement about All Star Wrestling that we thought it was lost forever. We have a lot of international wrestling, and we also have a few more recent matches like Kevin Steen, El Generico, and Pierre Calwellet in the three-way match in IWS in December of 2003. And also Kevin Steen against AJ Styles, two out of three falls match in May. Actually, on Kevin's birthday, May 2005 in EWR. So you might grab those as well on highspots.com or rfvideo.com. So, and I'm also involved in the HBO and WWE Under the Giant documentary. I'm also working on the documentary with them. So a lot of things are going on, John.
Well, always a busy man is Pat LaPrade, and I'll definitely have to ring up the Pat phone when the Maurice Mad Dog Vachon book comes out. Very much looking forward to that when I can sit down and read that, because Pat has done some phenomenal books over the years. So I highly recommend you checking them out, and appreciate all this time, Pat, coming out. I really want to hear, especially the early days of Kevin, because I know you wanted to see a little bit more in the documentary, and hopefully we got to dive a bit deeper today.
Well, my pleasure, and hopefully we can do that whenever Sami Zayn DVD will be released.
That's right. And WWE, interview this man. Put him in the documentary. If you can book him, he might be too busy. I mean, Jesus, he's all over the place.
I'll find a moment to be free.
Thanks as always, Pat. Appreciate it.
Thanks, John. Bye.
All right. Thank you to Pat LaPrade for joining us here on Review Away. And it's time to go to the Law Message Board. We'll take some of your feedback and then let you know what we are going to review next. We start off with Sean from Manchester, England. First of all, I'd like to welcome John back after his recent hiatus. Thank you very much. Another excellent documentary by the WWE. Great story told. Good to see that they got coverage from ROH, CZW, etc., which was vital in telling the story, and they interviewed the correct people with the likes of Sami Zayn, Neville, Jimmy Jacobs, Seth Rollins, which is far better than when they used to get the likes of Santino Marella and the Brooklyn Brawler as talking heads on what seemed like every single DVD. One of the biggest highlights of the documentary for me was the promo he cut on Sami Zayn at the Performance Center, which was superb. The documentary probably ends at the right time, as his title run didn't exactly set the world on fire, and his character currently is pretty stale.
We go to Christian, who says, I'm not breaking new ground when I say WWE make excellent documentaries. I thought they summed up Owens within the first 30 seconds when his little girl was at the top of the stairs. You could tell he adores his family. They also grabbed so many key figures in his stories like Zayn, Jacobs, Carino, and even Beef Wellington. I was originally a bit annoyed that the documentary was only an hour long, as I thought there was a lot more you could go into detail about, especially his constant battle with Jim Cornette backstage at ROH. But after watching the special features, that complaint was pretty much gone. I don't know why they didn't inject some of those features into the main documentary, as they did add a lot. It's not as if we didn't get to see them all. I imagine that they're probably wanting to keep it to an hour for future presentations on the network. That's my only thought.
Could be.
And whoever, who knows where else they might try to sell this thing.
Alex from Minneapolis. I really liked the documentary, as I felt it did a good job telling Kevin Owens' story. The only problem I feel is that WWE has gone into a pattern of making documentaries timed at an hour. Did you just read this one? No. It's just the same complaint.
No, but it's the same. Yeah.
Okay.
Obviously, they're doing it for a reason.
Yeah. He has some questions here. Do you guys know why Owens went from being the top guy in ROH to falling into the mid-card after losing the belt to Jay Briscoe before leaving a year later? I mean, it was a directional change that they made. I mean, Owens was still pretty featured as the leader of Scum throughout that time period as well. I mean, he wasn't the champion during that final year or so, but he was still a pretty featured guy. I wouldn't say he was being necessarily phased out or anything like that. He asked, does it look like PWG will be more willing to lend footage to WWE for their documentaries going forward? I think in fact, they did it here. It'll be a case-by-case basis.
But very noticeable how much less in comparison to Ring of Honor. And I imagine that might be a monetary thing or maybe a licensing thing.
Yeah. And also time-wise, I mean, I think they wanted to tell the ROH story because of the talking heads they had. And there was less from PWG, perhaps, to tell. Or at least that they were going to dedicate to. And do you guys think that the Steen Generico feud is overlooked, considering it used Final Battle as a storyline arc from 2009 to 12? I don't think so. I think that's one of the more well-remembered ROH feuds ever. I think it's held in pretty high regard for people because of the longevity and what the two have gone on to do, that their WWE feud has given a spotlight to that feud even more so. And this documentary will as well.
Mm-hmm. We got a Javier from Richfield. Really enjoyed the Owens documentary and felt it did a great job telling his story. Two questions. Is it fair to say that Owens is filling the void that CM Punk has left as far as the heel that the smart fans cheer for? Also, do you guys see WWE being able to get footage from TNA like they do with ROH if they plan on doing a documentary on Joe and AJ?
I mean, I think that you look at the roster in 2013, which was Punk's last full-time year, and look at the roster today. I mean, there's a ton of performers that I think the audience is going to latch on to.
As far as the man with the big mouth, you know, the man who's with the great wit, on the level of a CM Punk, I think Kevin Owens comes closest, if not surpasses.
I mean, they're both great promos. I guess I just don't really compare the two in my head, but yeah, certainly. In terms of TNA footage, I think if WWE wanted TNA footage, I don't think they would stand in the way if they were offering like a licensing deal for footage.
Do you think TNA and Anthem would be willing to work like that?
I think if they were willing to pay money, Anthem would definitely take it. Mm. I think so.
Yeah.
It would just be up to, is WWE wanting to go that route? ROH is one thing. Impact is another.
I have no doubt that they have already planned an AJ Styles documentary and a Samoa Joe documentary, seeing the success of you know, ones like these. And I imagine,
I think you have to then.
Much of the holdup is just that, the TNA thing.
Yeah, you're probably right. Like an AJ disc would do really well, and you mm-hmm. can't do an AJ documentary without Impact footage.
Can you do a Joe documentary without it?
I mean, the Joe Angle
thing is the biggest thing, you know, but like to me, like, you spend some time on the Ring of Honor stuff, which is, I think, still.
I think it would be definitely heavily criticized, but I think you can do a Joe one, though it's a major omission.
Yeah.
But an AJ one, I think, is really tough.
Yeah.
Because I don't think that they'll have New Japan footage either.
Hmm.
So that really leaves them empty on an AJ one. Chris from Melbourne is the last one. Without repeating what was already said, I forgot that for Kevin, English is a second language, and yet he still speaks so well. His promos are so much greater than most of the roster. A great look on his past, and I was surprised by how much ROH and independent footage that the WWE got. Which Sammy Kevin turn was the most shocking? ROH Final Battle or NXT TakeOver? I don't know. I don't know about shocking. You know, in 2009, I mean, the team, I think it was ready. I think they were ready to separate the team. And for TakeOver, like, I thought it was the perfect introduction to him.
Yeah.
I thought it was awesome that you got that reaction of the two embracing in the ring, and then you took it away from them. And those two have done such a great job of, in 2017, trying to maintain this story outside of just programming.
How long before we can have another turn between these two? What is kind of the refresh rate of a Steen Generico turn?
I think you have to team them up together first before you can. And to be honest, I feel they've kind of exhausted it. Like they have done so much that
already.
The only, I think you'd want to go the opposite. It's that you tease the reunion for a long time. And hey, who knows? Like with the success they've kind of felt in a short window with Rollins and Ambrose, that's something you can do with Steen and Zayn down the road is do the reunion together. And that could also lead to the Owens babyface run, which again, I feel they'll get to at some point down the road. All right. That's going to wrap up the show. So thank you for tuning in to another edition of Review Away. Mr. Ting and I are going to be back in 2 weeks time on Friday, August the 11th.
August.
Wow, you're excited.
No.
That is our last show before SummerSlam. So guess what event we are going to go back and chronicle, Way? We did a poll at the beginning of this show, and it was a nail biter. And we have the results. I put up four different SummerSlams, and eking things out by 3%, the SummerSlam we are going to review with 31% of our votes was SummerSlam 1999 from Minneapolis, Minnesota, headlined by Steve Austin, Triple H, and Mankind, with Jesse Ventura as the special referee.
That's not so bad.
And a Kiss My Ass match between The Rock and Billy Gunn.
Okay, I take it back.
You can compare Tanahashi and Billy Gunn to The Rock and Billy Gunn.
Well, thank you guys for making a great choice.
Hey, the other options were 1990, 96, and 2008. And no. It was a close one here. The others had 28, 26, and 15%. So
I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to those matches because I'm sure we'll have great conversations about them. But I'm also looking forward to the surprises on the undercards. Oh boy, do I love the undercards on these random shows.
Oh dude, this was the height of the Attitude Era where everything was insane. So That's what everyone gets to look forward to in 2 weeks.
I wonder if a young Kevin Owens was watching this.
Maybe he was.
Yeah.
He could have been.
Hmm.
All right. So that's going to wrap things up. How do you want to end this?
Why don't you sing us a song?
I can't sing a song. I can barely hear.
How about a poem?
A poem?
Yeah.
Today we did a documentary on Kevin Steen. At the beginning of the show, Wei Ting sounded very mean. I fucked up some facts. You could hardly call me a dean. But you know what? I'm getting super tired. I want to get something to eat. God forbid I get even more lean.
Oh my God. Wow. Bravo. Glad to have you back. Oh, that's awesome.